our first case. Would you call that one, please?
The first case for argument this morning, Thursday, February 15th, 2018, is 17-1327, District of Minnesota, United States versus Cinema Gay. 17-1347, District of Minnesota, United States versus Fennell Philly. And 17-1496, District of Minnesota, United States versus Prince Samoso.
All right. Mr. DeVore.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to speak with you this morning. I wanted to take my 5 minutes to hit on a few points that I touched in my brief. First is sophisticated means. We submit that the district court made clear error when it gave a two-point enhancement for sophisticated means in the sentence of Cinema Gay. The evidence in the case indicated that the true leader, James Capehart, actually recruited Mr. Gay and because he knew how to run a computer. The extent of his knowledge in this case had to do with how to print checks off of a computer, checks that were paper that was provided to him by Mr. Capehart, and a program that was purchased at the Office Max store by Mr. Capehart was given to Mr. Gay to use on a computer. The standard of analysis or the way to analyze the case for the court is to look at whether or not there was especially complex or especially intricate systems in place to conceal or to execute this type of an offense. As it pertains to my particular client, Mr. Gay, much of the work that he did was done either at his mother's kitchen on her computer or later in the basement of Mr. Capehart's home.
What was the duration of the scheme?
Your Honor, my client's involvement started in 2007 or 8, so his involvement was approximately 7 or 8 years, Your Honor.
And
I believe that
frequency
was
of the repetition of the activity?
Yes. As far as involvement, Your Honor, my client admitted that he was involved and probably did better than 1,000 transactions, Your Honor. So he was looked at and used quite frequently by Mr. Capehart. But as it relates specifically to the sophisticated means analysis and looking at the intricacy of it, in my client's involvement, it was a matter of just simply taking information that was provided to him and then plugging it into a program and printing out some checks. There is very little information to indicate that he actually utilized or did any kind of changing of any programs or anything like that. It was simply just a program they purchased at the store.
But this wasn't a one-man operation, though.
It was not.
There was coordination between the various defendants who had their tasks to complete the full scheme.
That's correct. That leads me into the role analysis, Your Honor, which, if I may, I believe as well, the court imposed a four-point enhancement. The court had
four levels.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. My apologies. The court had the opportunity to order zero, two, three, or four levels, and they chose to order four. Again, looking at the analysis of the court, the court should look at the defendant's role, whether or not he recruited accomplices, and the extent of his involvement in the planning and organizing of the scheme. I hit on a few things on the planning and organizing. We submit that Mr. Gay was simply somebody that received information, plugged it into the computer, and printed out checks. His recruitment, there is indication of some minimal recruitment, but those were what I call low-lying fruit, Your Honor, and those would be people that he knew, people that were looking for work, people that wanted to make money, and he simply introduced them into the system. But it wasn't an active recruiting process on behalf of my client. So I think the district court had the opportunity to impose a lower level enhancement in this particular, under the role enhancement.
What's our review standard for that?
I believe that is clear error, Your Honor. And then with respect to the obstruction of justice, I believe that as well is a clear error analysis. I will just submit to the court that there was no threats that were actually made, and in reviewing the transcript and the and listening to the telephone conversation, in response to being to my client being told that somebody had talked to defendant Gabor, my client's response was simply, okay. The government provided nothing to the district court to indicate that my client actively sought out to interfere with another defendant's testimony in the case. And so we believe that adding a two-level enhancement, was inappropriate of the district court. So, and I believe I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right. When you say the response was okay, are you referring to text messages or conversation?
It was a conversation, Your Honor. And his response was the word okay. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeVore. Mr. Altman.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Your Honors, I've selected one issue to argue before you today. And I'm asking on behalf of perhaps many people for some guidance from this court about the preponderance of the evidence standard that applies, that is the government's burden of persuasion in calculating the amount of loss. Unfortunately, when we talk about the preponderance, we phrase it in terms of only a preponderance of the evidence. And
well, that's in contrast to a higher standard that would take considerably more. It doesn't mean that it's not a significant amount. It just means it's less than the higher standard.
That's correct. And it is not a toothless tiger. It must mean something. Well, let me set the table for you here, Your Honors. In this case, my client entered a straight plea to four substantive counts, one conspiracy count. Four substantive counts were all in the spring and early summer of 2013. There was the case was hotly litigated, and at a certain point in time, Judge Thunheim decided that he wanted to have an evidentiary hearing on the various sentencing objections. So that was held, and I believe my co-defendants were also at this hearing. And in connection with my client, Mr. Somoso, the government put forward a schedule in Exhibit 6 to this evidentiary hearing and authenticated it in this manner. Quote, and this is some agent speaking about this Exhibit 6, quote, this is the loss schedule that we prepare during the time frame in which we believe Mr. Somoso was involved in the conspiracy, and this is also sorted by date. Now, it's interesting, if you review this evidentiary hearing transcript, that same exact formulation is also ascribed to the schedules of his co-defendants. So there was some art, there was some scripting of this. Now, this Exhibit 6 had 1,557 entries and calculated about 770,000 and change in actual loss. My client, Mr. Somoso, was tied to six of these 1,557 entries. The four transactions which tied into the substantive bank fraud counts that he pled guilty to, the ones that occurred in May and June and July of 2013, and also two others, which are actually scheduled out. And the only two that I found, he was even mentioned by name, and I exhibited that as Exhibit 2 in the addendum. Now these particular entries were for transactions in 2007 and 2008. So their own exhibit has got a hiatus between 2007 and 2013. And we know why, because Mr. Somoza wasn't around. He was in North Dakota, and he was also, I believe, in Worthington, Minnesota for a time. This was corroborated in the PSI, and as a matter of fact, the court at the time of sentencing stated that he was sometimes in and sometimes out of the conspiracy. Now, while we understand that the preponderance standard may not be a high bar, it's not a low one either. And what are you supposed to do with an exhibit like this that's authenticated based upon the belief of the agent and corroborates the fact?
What was the objection made to it?
There was, I looked that up yesterday, Your Honor. There was no objection made by...
So the review is plain error?
Normally I would say yes, but the record is peppered with objections about the amount of loss made by Mr. Wolf, who was trial counsel for Mr. Somoza. He sets that out in his position on sentencing. The objection is also lodged in the pre-sentence investigation report at the end there. And I believe there may have been some other briefing. So,
is your argument that the government didn't prove what was in the exhibit, or is your argument that your client should only be accountable for his own specific transactions?
That ultimately is the argument.
The latter?
The latter.
Well, what do you do with the relevant conduct guideline and the law? This isn't a preponderance question. This is a legal question. He's accountable for all acts of the jointly undertaken activity that are reasonably foreseeable to him and taken in furtherance of the activity.
Well, and which is the correct standard, but when you're not around, I don't know, you know, how you can reasonably foresee anything.
Well, there was evidence that some of these transactions showed on a cell phone that was found in his possession. Not, you don't have to be physically present to be able to be involved.
That could be, but he was also quite a ways away. I mean, Fargo and Worthington.
The distance is not the criteria, is it?
Probably not, Your Honors.
Well, it'd be one thing if I thought you said he was in and out, meaning he would go for a while to Worthington or Fargo, then he'd come back.
I think so.
If the judge found, well, he was in and out, but it was reasonably foreseeable to him that the conspiracy was ongoing even when he was out of town, say, why would that be clear error?
Well, because for one thing, because the government's proof doesn't... the proof in terms of the transactional proof doesn't... go to Mr. Somoza when he's not around. It's
okay.
Just not there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. McCauley.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name's Jennifer McCauley, and I represent the appellant Fino Philly. I'd like to focus my time on the loss amount issue. That's an issue that's shared by all three of the appellants here. And we were able to discuss a little bit about the preponderance standard. The court mentioned the relevant conduct guideline, and much of the evidence that the government sought to admit mostly through this summary exhibit with really virtually no foundation. Most of it was brought in under that relevant conduct guideline.
I still wasn't clear whether you and your colleagues are saying because there was insufficient foundation, the amounts in the exhibit are not proved, or whether you're just saying, yes, they were proved, but they shouldn't be attributed to my client.
They weren't proved, and they should not be. They are not connected to the conspiracy or to the defendants that were at this sentencing hearing. I think we would, in the event that this case had gone to trial, then the government would have introduced this evidence to prove the conspiracy, and that evidence would be then before the court. But just because we didn't have a trial doesn't mean we can skip that step when we come to sentencing. And that's what it appears happened. There really is just a dearth of evidence that comes in that connects the people. And the way
What objections, how was this brought to the attention of the district court?
In all of the defendants' sentencing pleadings, position pleadings, and objections to the PSR, these objections were made. Particularly when the enhanced loss amount came to everyone's attention for the first time in this PSR. The indictment references for the aggregate amount of loss for all of the defendants, something like $150,000 or thereabouts. The amount that my client's expert witness was able to adduce at trial for an actual loss was closer to $40,000. So the amounts that are out there are really, really vastly different than the evidence that anybody could possibly pull from this record. But the relevant conduct guideline is interpreted by the district court and by the approach I think that's advanced by the government here, which is a very liberal approach, that it's almost as if there's some connection somewhere, then it would be enough for this conduct to come in under the guideline. And that was how all of this evidence with virtually no foundation was glommed on to the actual loss and attributed to these defendants. I would direct the court's attention to the fact that the focus for the purposes of relevant conduct is on each individual defendant's criminal undertaking and the loss foreseeable in light of that particular undertaking. So we're not looking at, for the relevant conduct and loss amount purposes, all of the conduct in the conspiracy. We are laser focused on the conduct that had something to do with each defendant. They cannot, and we'll note all three of the defendants here, were held to be attributable to this significantly enhanced loss that's attributable to this summary
chart.
What was
the stipulation?
What
was the effect of the stipulation on
the plea agreement?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so my client's case is a little bit different because he moved to, he asked the court to withdraw from his plea agreement. The district court, in that hearing, inquired of him, you know, what's the issue here? He was upset about the sentencing stipulations that were included in his plea agreement. And the discussion that he had with the district court on the record clarified that he would be permitted, the way the court phrased it is, these are sentencing stipulations. The district court's not bound by these sentencing stipulations. And therefore, you are free to, and it's okay for you to argue for a lesser amount. Now, the sentencing stipulation, the amounts that are in the plea agreement will matter for the purposes of restitution. There's a constitutional concern there because if we go over the amount that he agrees to there, which was something like $400,000.
It was five, but...
I don't know off the top of my head. Something around that range, but less than what he's actually been cited to. There's a Sixth Amendment concern. And to that end, I know that the government's position has been that when my client tried to withdraw from his guilty plea in that plea agreement, that he repudiated that amount. But that assumes that the Sixth Amendment protects the government in the same way that it protects a defendant. The Sixth Amendment concern is for the defendant's right to be able to bring his case to the court and to have sufficient evidence adduced to support that amount. The concern is not for the government's burden or shifted burden when the court allows the defendant to argue the sentencing stipulations despite his plea agreement. And I think The most important part in this, I think that restitution and the loss amount kind of come together here because the court did adopt the same amount for actual loss amount for sentencing enhancement purposes and for restitution. And we know that those amounts came off of this summary chart. The evidence that was adduced at the sentencing hearing as it relates to that is so slim that it sort of, I mean, the testimony that we had from the special agent on the case was, did you personally review every check? I did. Did you confirm the checks and the schedules had the right amounts? Yes. In the intended and actual losses? Yes. And that they are connected to the conspiracy. A gigantic legal conclusion here being made by the case agent. Yes, they're connected to the conspiracy. That's our evidence. That's the evidence that connects this for relevant conduct purposes or for enhancement purposes. And as it relates to my client and the other two defendants here, that's simply not enough. I'd ask to reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
Well, did you have time to cross?
I'm sorry?
Did you have time to cross-examine?
I wasn't trial counsel. So did we have time to cross-examine the case agent? I'm certain that we did. I don't have the entire transcript in front of me, but I will take a look at that.
Good.
Thanks, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. McCauley. Mr. Gingrich?
May it please the court, and good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, counsel.
David Gingrich on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, I'd like to take the issues in roughly reverse order from the way they were presented to you this morning and start with loss amount, given it is common to all three appellants, and then work backwards from there. With respect to loss amount, I'd just like to take perhaps a half a step back and discuss the framework that applies to jointly undertaken criminal activity for purposes of relevant conduct. There is no question here that each of these defendants participated in a conspiracy. There's no question that they each, by virtue of their plea agreement, admitted that the conspiracy extended from at least 2007 until 2013. And there's no question that, given they all pled to the indictment, that they admitted to what the nature and scope of the conspiracy was with respect to, example, manufacturers, runners, recruiters, bank insiders being involved in the conspiracy. What matters for guidelines purposes is once you have jointly undertaken criminal activity, and every single appellant here admitted that they engaged in jointly undertaken criminal activity, what does the district court look to decide what the relevant conduct losses are? And as this court knows, it's a three-prong standard or test. What was the scope of jointly undertaken criminal activity by the particular defendant? Was that activity in furtherance of the conspiracy? And was it reasonably foreseeable from the defendant's vantage point that the relevant conduct losses would accrue as a result of the conspiracy? That was the question before the district court. And that question was not answered merely by submission of a loss chart. The contested evidentiary hearing in this case was over 200 pages of court transcript. There were something like 80 or 90 exhibits admitted by the government. It was not limited to three lines of a transcript with conclusory summation by a case agent. This case is far from that. There was a detailed and extensive evidentiary hearing. To Judge Murphy's question, the agents absolutely were cross-examined, and in fact, one or more of the defendants put their own witnesses on at this hearing. The district court had an ample factual basis here to draw the conclusions it did, and they certainly were not clearly erroneous under the preponderance of the evidence standard.
Well, on the chart, counsel said earlier, or suggested, I guess you could say, that the only evidence showing that all of the transactions were part of the conspiracy was the agent saying they were all connected to the conspiracy. Now, you said there were 90 exhibits, but I gather you didn't introduce the underlying documents as to each transaction on the chart?
No, Your Honor, and certainly as the court knows, for a summary chart purpose, particularly one that's unobjected to, not all of the underlying documents need be admitted. But if I could explain what the government did present at the sentencing evidentiary hearing, that would satisfy the district court that its factual findings were sound. The government presented in its evidence, and this is summarized in the government.
Often a summary chart is offered after the underlying evidence is offered. This sounds like the summary chart was offered without the underlying evidence. So why don't you go ahead and explain how all the items on the chart were proved.
Thank you, Your Honor. And as to the sequence of its admission, I'm not sure whether it was admitted at the beginning or the end of the hearing, but it certainly was admitted in the context of a hearing, again, that was at least half a day, maybe more, and
well,
comprised.
I wasn't speaking to the sequence so much as the fact that it's usually in conjunction with the underlying evidence. And you said, no, there weren't.
So what
as to each transaction here. So go ahead.
What the underlying evidence demonstrated with respect to each of these defendants' joint undertaking, that is the scope of the activity they undertook, was that, for example, with respect to Gay, and this was demonstrated, first let me talk about the nature of the evidence, which I think is responsive in part to the court's evidence. What the government demonstrated by exhibits and testimony was that the agents in this case executed search warrants where they gathered computers, cell phones, documents from the cars and residences of various defendants. They conducted trash pulls while the investigation was active, from which they recovered check stock, checks that had been used in the conspiracy, facsimile signatures of victims' names, checks that had been ripped up in the course of manufacturing. They conducted surveillance at the residences of participants in the conspiracy, including Mr. Gay and Mr. Philly. Mr. Somoza was seen at those residences with the co-conspirators and admitted in connection with that evidence a statement of Mr. Cannaday, who's a co-defendant, who attended those meetings and indicated that at those meetings, part of the scope of jointly undertaking criminal activity discussed were things like divvying up the proceeds, the reliability of co-conspirators, and the use of runners and the timing of various transactions. There was also underlying documentation admitted as to some of the transactions, certainly not all 1,500 that were involved in this conspiracy. And as the agents testified, the reason a particular transaction was included on the loss chart related to identification of the runner as being involved in the conspiracy and using transactions associated with that runner, identification of accounts that had been used by Gay, Philly, and others to manufacture checks and tracing the losses to those accounts, and identification of co-conspirators and bank insiders who had compromised account information and handed them over to co-conspirators. Text messages were also admitted.
Who testified to what you're just describing there? Which agent?
I actually can't recall the name. It was the first. The government called two case agents. I believe the IRS agent was Shannon Corpola. It would have been the other agent whose name I don't recall. I apologize, Your Honor. It would have been the first witness called by the government.
But you're saying that agent went through what you just described as to how they decided to include transactions on the chart?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And, in fact, there's explicit testimony from the government that what was not included on the loss chart were transactions that, for example, a runner might have conducted, one of the runners in the conspiracy might have conducted a fraudulent check transaction. But if that could not be linked to the conspiracy via account number, recruiter, bank insider, manufacturer, then it wasn't included. It wasn't enough, quote-unquote, merely that a runner identified as part of the conspiracy negotiated a check. There had to be other connections to the conspiracy, and that's testified to explicitly during the hearing. And what this is meant to inform, what this evidence is meant to inform, once you have the defendants involved in the conspiracy, is whether all of the losses during their period of activity are attributable to them under relevant conduct principles. And as this court knows, that extends well beyond whether they individually conducted any particular transaction. Indeed, that's what animates relevant conduct. The inquiry is, did they undertake in a joint criminal activity that for each of them made it reasonably foreseeable that the conspiracy's losses as a whole should be attributable to them? Now, the government and the district court took a considered approach in this case. 25 defendants pled guilty as part of the same indictment that Mr. Gay, Philly, and Somoza were indicted for. 24 pled to conspiracy to commit bank fraud. Of those, only 7 or 8 held accountable for losses that spanned their participation in conspiracy under jointly undertaken relevant conduct principles. The runners, for example, were only held accountable for the losses attributable to their particular transactions, because the runners standing at the bottom of the ladder do not have the scope of jointly undertaken activity, as do Philly, Gay, and Somoza, operating as manufacturers, recruiters, and supervisors of others in the conspiracy. The bank insiders in this conspiracy were only held accountable for the losses attributable to the particular bank accounts that they compromised and handed over to the conspiracy. The recruiters were only held accountable for the fraudulent transactions attributable to those individuals that that were linked to them, that they had recruited.
And why was that? These people could not reasonably foresee that the conspiracy was larger than their own conduct?
It was arguably, Your Honor, a conservative approach, but I think consistent with the commentary and the guidelines, and here's why. The commentary and the guidelines on the scope of undertaking criminal activity, for example, in the drug context, one of the examples is, I think, a significant other or a girlfriend of a, let's characterize it as a drug kingpin. And what the commentary says is that person may know that their drug kingpin significant other is engaged in trafficking huge amounts of drugs. But that spouse or significant other only undertakes, say, to deliver one shipment. And what the commentary says is that drug runner is only liable for one shipment because that was the extent of the scope of that person's activity, even if it was foreseeable that the conspiracy was engaging in other activity. And Mr. Philly, in his brief, cites from this court's precedent, this court's authority, for that principle, that it's not enough that you could foresee that the conspiracy was active in this area. You've got to, the scope of the jointly undertaken criminal activity has to be something that you have a vantage point on with respect to reasonable foreseeability, but also be consistent with what you actually undertake. And that's why these gradations or these differentiations were made by the district court, consistent with the government's submission to the district court in this case. And let me turn it on its head. There's really a theme, I think, through all three of the appellant's briefs, that what the government did here was misapprehend the law, that the government thought once someone participates in a conspiracy that they're accountable for all the losses, and that other than three or four lines in the contested evidentiary hearing transcript, the government just assumed that each of their clients was accountable for everything because they were involved in the conspiracy. And what the record reveals is that that was not the approach taken by the district court or the government. Not everyone who pled guilty to conspiracy to commit bank fraud, the same conspiracy that these three appellants pled to, was held accountable for all of the conspiracy's losses. Rather, the district court and the government applied the three-part test that applies to jointly undertaking criminal activity and focused like a laser on each individual defendant's scope and vantage point and role in the conspiracy. That's why the transcript is as detailed as it is. That's why the nature of the exhibits span trash pulls, search warrants, surveillance, text messages, statements of witnesses, including runners, as well as direct evidence related to the transactions, bank account information and the like, forensic evidence with respect to computers as well. And those showings were all aimed at a single purpose, and that was to demonstrate with respect to each of these appellants what the scope of their jointly undertaken criminal activity was, and that approach was differentiated from other members of the conspiracy who did not participate, did not have the same scope as is set forth both in the evidentiary hearing and in the government's brief. I would also, if I could, there is one area, Your Honors, I think I was not as helpful to the court as I could have been in the briefing, and I'd just like to refer to the court to some filings in district court that I think are helpful. One of the factors in this court's precedent with respect to scope of the undertaking is to the extent in which the co-conspirators coordinated and cooperated and shared resources and benefited from their joint participation. And the government covered this in some detail in the district court. With respect to Gay, I would just refer the court to district court docket number 1292 at pages 18 through 24. With respect to Philly, I would respectfully refer the court to District Court Docket Number 1278, and that's a government brief summarizing the sentencing evidentiary hearing evidence at pages 15 to 22. And as to Mr. Somoza, I'd refer the court respectfully to District Court Number 1277 from pages 4 to 8. And what those filings demonstrate, and they cite to the sentencing evidentiary hearing, is that there was a coordinated effort here. In other words, the scope of the jointly undertaken activity was mutually reinforcing, and that none of these three appellants operated in silos, but rather the nature and extent of their cooperation depended on the fact that they were cooperating with the others, including the manufacturers, runners, and recruiters. I would like to say just a word, Your Honors, on restitution with respect to Mr. Philly. Mr. Philly and the government stipulated to a restitution amount. Mr. Philly then, and I think repudiated is absolutely an accurate term. In fact, if you look at Philly's appellant's brief at page 10, it indicates that Mr. Philly, after being given leave by the district court to withdraw from his stipulations, objected to restitution. That's also found at page 5 of Mr. Philly's sentencing pleading in district court. Mr. Philly then asserted that the loss amount, I think, was south of $50,000. The district court therefore held a contested sentencing evidentiary hearing on loss, given Mr. Philly's repudiation of his prior stipulated loss amount. And the district court did what it was legally required to do under the Restitution Act, which is once the district court established a restitution amount, it imposed the actual loss restitution amount under the statute. And if you go to the plea transcript for Mr. Philly, toward the end, I don't have the page site, I apologize, the district court is clear right from the beginning that restitution depends ultimately on the factual findings that the district court makes as to loss. And the district court is clear that the stipulations are not binding upon it. Here, Mr. Philly wants the benefit of engaging in a plea agreement with the government where the sides mutually agree to a restitution amount, then wants to repudiate his stipulation as to restitution, but then argue that the district court's bound by the government's prior agreement, which is no longer a meeting of the minds between the parties. And the government would suggest not only is there no Sixth Amendment interest, but the district court certainly committed no error in imposing what it found was the actual loss amount in this case. Your Honor, with respect to the arguments made by Mr. Gay, with respect to Mr. Somoza first, and this idea of loss and his participation in the conspiracy, what I'd first note as a factual matter is what the PSR in paragraphs, I think, 195 and 197, as cited by Mr. Somoza's brief, establish is that Mr. Somoza was absent for less than 3 months in 2011, and he was absent for less than 3 months in 2013. And that's the extent of the record with respect to Mr. Somoza's absence from the Twin Cities metro area during this conspiracy. So there was no extended period of absence, and as Chief Judge Smith noted, physical absence isn't the standard, and I think as Judge Colleton, you noted, the duration of that absence isn't the standard. What is the standard? The standard is once you engage in a conspiracy and the court draws conclusions about the scope of your jointly undertaken criminal activity, did you withdraw from that activity, and was it no longer reasonably foreseeable what the conspiracy was doing? Well, in this case, Your Honors, it's not a matter of Somoza entering the conspiracy in 2007, leaving town, and the government saying, well, you're accountable for everything until the conspiracy ended in 2013. What occurred here is that Mr. Somoza participated in the conspiracy beginning in 2007, which the district court found is acknowledged by appellant, and participated as late as 2013, and that was documented at the sentencing evidentiary hearing, and it was pled to by Mr. Somoza as part of his plea. So this isn't initial entry and then just run the cash register through the end of the conspiracy. Mr. Somoza was involved at all material times in the conspiracy, beginning and end, 2007, 2013. And he has not demonstrated certainly not by showing an absence for less than 3 months, a total of less than 6 months over 6 years, that he withdrew for the conspiracy for purposes of relevant conduct. The preponderance standard is not toothless, but it was more than satisfied in this case. And respectfully, I think much of the appellant's arguments goes no further than saying they can only be held accountable for what they individually participated in and really ignore the district court's work in conducting a contested evidentiary hearing and receiving the exhibits of both parties.
Yeah, I had a question about the proffer agreement.
Yes, sir. Yes,
morning.
Yes, sir.
You know, the agreement says that it can be used, rather the information can be used I thought I had it in front of me, but it lists argument. You probably remember that.
Evidence, argument, and representations.
Yeah. So if the defendant objects to something in the PSR, are you saying that by itself triggers the opportunity to use the information, or does it require more than that?
Your Honor, I think an objection to the PSR is a denial of the facts set forth in the PSR, and this court has used in prior cases this notion of a denial, including the Al-Qaeda case cited in the government's brief. If Judge Kyle...
objection was... are you sure an objection is a denial as opposed to a demand that the government meet its burden of proof?
I think it's a fair point, Your Honor. I think it can be characterized both ways. And, in fact, Gay in this case characterized one of his objections as, I don't know the source of the information. He says, I deny it, and I don't know the source. And if I could have just a moment to respond, Your Honor,
yes.
Perhaps 30 seconds,
yeah,
Your Honor.
I mean,
thank
what
you.
What I'm concerned about is just potential for abuse here. You know, if the government gets a proffer and then the PSR, through an unidentified source, puts in the information that's in the proffer, and then the defendant objects to it because he doesn't know where the government got it other than from him. And then the government says, well, we can use your proffer to show it.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I suppose you're going to say, well, there was some other source for this information here, but I'm still wondering whether an objection by itself is enough to allow the proffer. I mean, if he objects and you had other sources, then you could have used the other sources to prove it up.
Your Honor, it's absolutely a fair question as to what the scope of an objection is in any particular case. And the way I would respond to your inquiry in the context of this case is that what Gay did in this case was not just issue an objection to the PSR. And this is set forth both below in the district court and in the appellee's brief. What Gay did here was explicitly deny that he manufactured checks, participated with runners, and engaged in fraudulent transactions. He explicitly denied.
What do you mean he denied? I mean, did he testify that he denied?
No. And
his lawyer wrote a letter and said, we object to this paragraph. My guy didn't do these things.
Correct. But it's that second part, Your Honor. My guy didn't.
Okay, go ahead.
He didn't. The way at least the government can.
That's an argument, not.
Exactly.
So if he had just said, we object to this paragraph and nothing more.
I think it's.
And he's thinking I didn't do it, but he's just objecting because he knows then you have to prove it up. That would be different.
I think it'd be a closer case, Your Honor, much closer. The record doesn't approach that. It doesn't approach that in this case. The defendant did not merely lodge an objection, and perhaps.
I wonder if there's any legal effect to what he did other than lodging an objection. You know, even if somebody objects and then elaborates. What's the purpose of the elaboration? It's not evidence. It's all the legal effect is to put the government to its burden.
Well, when the district court's entitled to rely on the facts of the PSR, as the court knows, if there's no objection. What the defendant is doing is stating his position as to the facts set forth in the PSR. And in this case, the defendant denied that he did things in the PSR that absolutely, unequivocally, he admitted to in his proffer letter. Unequivocally. The proffer letter provides that the government can use it if he makes evidence, argument, or representations. And any time a defense counsel makes representations with respect to a PSR, He's making those representations on behalf of the defendant. In fact, the letter, the proffer letter says, by or on behalf of the defendant. And that's what was done with respect to the PSR here.
Okay. So you're saying the objections included argument.
And absolutely.
And that argument opened up the use of the proffer.
Absolutely, and I don't have the district court docket number, but if the I did cite it in the brief. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chief.
And thank you, Chief Judge, for the extra time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Ms. McCauley, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Murphy, I do not have the sentencing transcript with me, unfortunately, but I can tell you just my recollection, which is that both Mr. Philly and Mr. Gay, at least, had presented experts who went through the details of the actual evidence that came from garbage pulls or any other evidence that the government had submitted and went through forensically and said what they could potentially be connected to. There was significant testimony from both of those experts, so a lot of the evidence that the government's referring to was adduced by the defendants. So to that extent, I can't tell you exactly what happened with testimony and cross-examination, but that evidence would have undermined this sort of conclusory exhibit without foundation that came in from the government. I know that the government's position is that we're overstating our case and saying that they're asking to have everything in the conspiracy added on. We're not saying that the defendant should not be responsible for the actual losses that they are connected to or that were reasonably foreseeable to them in light of the undertaking that they were involved in. They're just not automatically, and I don't think the government's saying that they're automatically responsible for everything in the conspiracy. The problem here is there's a lack of evidentiary nexus between evidence that has to do with other people's fraud and an individual defendant. There's nothing connecting those dots. And so that makes the connection doesn't fit within the definition of relevant conduct. That's the primary concern with the loss amount as it was adopted by the district court. Unless the court has further questions for me, I
see none.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court notes that counsel for the appellants in this case are serving under the Criminal Justice Act as appointed counsel, and we wish to express to you our gratitude for your willingness to serve in that regard. Thank you. May be excused.